Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Well, good morning. The title of my talk is Patience Unto the Day of the Lord. And that phrase, Day of the Lord, gets in there. It's a Pauline phrase. It's one of his ways of talking about the topic of the conference in general. What I want to speak, though, to you about this morning isn't so much about the Day of the Lord, about its about our capacity to anticipate it or what it will be like. I want to speak rather about patience, which according to Thomas Aquinas and his contemporaries and predecessors and many others besides, is a moral virtue that is a part of fortitude and has to do with the moderation of sorrow. And the way I want to frame this is by pointing back now to one of the passages we were looking at last night from Luke 21. And there's a line in here in the midst of many other things where the Lord says to the disciples, and I think by extension to us, "You will be hated by all for my name's sake. Not a hair of your head will perish. In your patience, you shall possess your souls." That's Luke 21, 17 through 19. Now that last sentence there on your handout, "In your patience, you shall possess your souls," comes from the Vulgate's rendering of that phrase. And you may not have encountered it in just this sense if you're reading something like the Revised Standard Version or the English Standard Version, but I want to think now with you this morning about what this means. What does it mean to say, first, you'll be hated? Second, what does it mean to say that in your patience, you shall possess your souls? Well, I do not know the day or the hour in which the Lord will return. I do not know and have some reservations about others who think they can know what the time at the end of time will be like. But I do know one thing, certainly, is that in at least many places, increasingly, it seems as though Catholic Christians are indeed objects of hatred. And what I mean by that is something very specific. That word hatred is a very charged word. What I mean by hatred here in the most general sense is a kind of aversion, a revulsion towards something perceived as dissonant and malicious. Now, something shows up for us as an object of hatred only in light of our own hopes and aspirations and our thoughts about what's good, right, and so on. So to say that something is an object of hatred in contemporary culture, or a person or group of people will be an object of hatred, is just to say that they're perceived as being incommensurate with, in some way contrary to, out of step with, or a kind of impediment to the aspirations of the time. But I don't really want to talk about the extent to which Catholic Christians, Christians more generally, are increasingly perceived as hateful persons, things. I'm actually more interested this morning in the extent to which it becomes a temptation for Christians to hate those by whom they are hated in turn. Hatred is a ossifying reality. When it sets in and takes root in the soul, it is difficult to root out. So to begin talking about this, I want to just step back and begin to think about what it is when we're talking about things like hatred and the other passions of the soul. And the reason for this, by way of preview, is to help make sense of this passage in which we're told that in our patience we'll possess our souls. I want to begin by talking about passions more generally, not simply hatred or sorrow, but human emotion or affection as such. This is a way of bringing into focus something about sorrow and its relationship to other emotions in our lives. And this is all important for understanding what Thomas means by the virtue of patience. And this is going to, I think, help us double back then on this passage from the Gospel with a little bit of help from Gregory the Great. So let me just begin then with this idea of the passions of the soul. Okay, so I'm not going to go through this whole list here, but what I've tried to do is give you a representative list of what Thomas calls passions. A passion, in the most general sense, these are all contested and disputed terms, but we speak of these things today in terms of emotion or affection. Okay, these are distinct from actions in the specific sense, insofar as they connote, involve a kind of undergoing. You know, when we feel ourselves in the grip of some passion, we feel ourselves awash in it. There's a kind of passivity. It's almost like it's less like something we're doing, though it is in fact something we're doing, but it seems more like something that is happening to us in a way. And you can hear that in the very notion of a passio in the Latin. It just means to undergo. Okay? So Thomas's idea, and he really has given us, I think, one of the most, if not the most subtle and sophisticated account of human passions that we have. There was never anything like it before he wrote this, and there's really never been anything like it since. But his idea is that all of the passions have some kind of object which makes them distinct from the others. Okay? Let me give you an example. We got into town the day before, got off the plane, the 6-hour transcontinental flight. We were dehydrated. I'm trying to figure out where we were. We left the Priory and we're walking to find something to eat. And wafting through the air is the smell from Zachary's Pizza down the street. And I thought to myself, this is a very nerdy thing to think, and it's a hazard of being a medievalist. But I thought, now that's called sensitive appetite. What I was thinking was, you know, I am being pulled toward something right now and I can't even tell where it's coming from. I mean, I'm looking around, you know, and it's a very bodily engaged thing. I'm thinking, and in my eyes fix on this pizza spot. And now I'm thinking, how am I going to convince these people that this is the thing that has to happen? We've got to go to this pizza. What is that moment there, that first moment where in the apprehension, the taking in of something present and that seems suitable? I mean, like simpatico, that smell is for me and I'm for it. This is good. What is that moment? Thomas calls that love. You know, I mean, try this. Try this. You've never heard John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. Put it on next time you're alone. I don't know, and maybe this is not the right kind of example, but if you're like me, the first time you heard that opening stanza, you thought, oh, this is good. This is just for me. Somehow I go with this. Right? When we are first captivated by something we perceive as good in some way, as suiting us, as being fit with ourselves and how we understand ourselves to be, we are caught up in these moments in the most general sense, what Thomas describes as a kind of love. And following that, okay, comes another passion, which is desire. Okay, so if the object of love is some present suitable good, okay, the object of desire is some future suitable good. Now I'm not just recognizing the goodness of the smell of this pizza. I'm now moving toward it. I've now cognized it under in a different way and said, not only is this is good for me to consume. I should be so united with it that I literally eat it. And now I'm no longer in the grip of love, but in the grip of desire. And later on in that evening, as I'm eating this delicious deep dish Chicago style pizza, which is kind of strange to find here in Oakland, but it was on point. I'm now not simply in the grip of love, and I'm no longer desiring this thing. I'm now enjoying it. The object of joy is the conjunction with some object of love. Right. So I love things. I love pizza. I desire pizza. I enjoy pizza. These are three different ways of relating to the same thing. Okay. So what I'm trying to do is just to spell out in a very broad brush way the difference between these different emotions. Now you can begin to think about other emotions that are like this but are in some way opposite to them. So what is sorrow? Well, it's the in a sense, it's the opposite of joy. We find ourselves in the grip of sorrow when we find ourselves in the presence of something we take to be evil, bad, repugnant, contrary to our well-being or the well-being of those whom we love. Okay, so the destruction of something good is cause for sorrow. The loss of something or someone good is cause for sorrow. Okay, but we can keep going. Suppose now I've lost something or someone very dear to me, but I have it in my mind that somehow this relationship, for example, could be recovered. Yes, it may take some difficulty. There may be great trials involved and sacrifices. But insofar as I take something to be good and possible to achieve, despite its difficulty, I'm now engaged in what Thomas calls hope. The object of every hope is some future good that is perceived as difficult but possible to achieve. Okay. Couple more. Despair. You know, despair. Despair is like hope, except in this way. When we hope, we find ourselves captivated with something good, far off, difficult, impossible to achieve. Despair is like this, except for the fact that we can't stop desiring in something that we are convinced is impossible to get. Right? So embedded within despair is a sense that there's something that could be had, and it would be good to have it. And you wouldn't be despairing if you didn't think that were so, but the difference here between despair and hope is just this, that thing that you can't stop wanting is reckoned as virtually impossible to get. So fear is the apprehension and the emotive response to the apprehension of some future evil that cannot be conquered or avoided. Right? If you could work your way around it, you could avoid it in some way, or if you could overcome that thing, the response wouldn't be fear, but it would be a kind of daring. A kind of chutzpah. Last one. Anger. Anger is an interesting passion insofar as it's really the conjunction of two passions. Thomas says, in every instance of anger, you have, on the one hand, sorrow, and on the other hand, desire, specifically for the desire of vindication. So suppose you offend me deeply. I don't know, there's like a group meet going right now and everyone's talking about how terrible this lecture is. I don't know how you all communicate anymore. There you go. It doesn't matter. All right. But just suppose I find out about this and I'm invested enough in our fledgling friendships to really be hurt by this. That's a moment of sorrow. Now, most of us, well, if you're like me at least, have a hard time recognizing the sorrow ingredient in anger because there's another emotion that gets piled on top of that first moment, and it happens really quickly because the sorrow gets eclipsed by the sense, I deserve to be respected. I'm going to get these people. I'm going to go and I'm going to steal all their toothbrushes. I'm going to, right, who knows what, right? I'm going to write all their professors and tell them how nasty they are. I don't know. Okay. There's anger, right? The recognition of something, some good that's been lost, something that's been damaged, right? And then the desire to rectify that or to vindicate oneself in some way. Now, here's the thing I want you to see about all this. All these things are connected. And they are connected and can be connected in innumerable ways. But there are a set of relations that obtain between these various passions that I've tried to describe just now that are fairly recognizable and routine in our lives. And to begin seeing this, you have to begin by recognizing that just human beings as a class, okay, I'm talking about just in terms of our creatureliness. We are not very adept at living with sorrow for very long. Okay? Sorrow is a killer. Sorrow, grief, if it's unchecked and it hangs around too long and it's not tended to in the right kind of way, can have innumerable effects on us, both spiritual and physical. Okay? We don't like to be around things that grieve us or that we recognize as being unfitting in some way. And this is one of the reasons why we are so quickly moved toward the pursuit of frivolous pleasures. I'm talking about distraction. All right, so I was on the plane on the way here, and there was a person in my row, and we were on the plane for, I think, 6 hours, and it was, this person's on their phone the entire time, and they're looking virtually the entire plane ride at videos that are lasting something like 10 seconds. I don't know how many 10-second videos it would take to fill up 6 hours, but that's about how many this person watched. And as I was sitting there looking at this person through my Thomistic eyes, I thought, what is he avoiding? What is so unpleasant about this moment that something like that would be appealing? We are pursuers of frivolous pleasure, and these pursuits often drag us into vices that can disrupt our lives and sow chaos in them and for ourselves and for others. For a somewhat different reason, unchecked sorrow can be cause for a kind of festering hatred. Right? So suppose now I'm deeply troubled by how out of tune I feel with my classmates. It's like I can't, it's like if I could, I would never be able to say what I want to say in this moment, in this class, vis-a-vis this topic, because to do so would earn me so much social scorn that it's better just to keep quiet. Now there's an object of sorrow, but it's not one that's likely to go away. Not at Berkeley. So now I have before me an object of sorrow that I have a deep aversion toward. But I can't quell the sorrow by changing the situation. And so I'm at a moment where there's an opportunity for something called hatred here. I set myself against these people. I regard them as my enemies. They are, because what they're saying and what they're doing and what they're saying about people like me is inimical to my flourishing. Sorrow, if unchecked, gives way to hatred. Hatred, if unchecked, gives way to anger. These people are going to get it one day. Ooh, did they read? They haven't read Bellarmine's treatise on the Antichrist. They have no idea what's coming. These are real things. these resentments, this kind of anger, the despair, the hopelessness of things ever being different with your peers. These are real things, and they all begin with very often do begin with a kind of sorrow about the loss of something good, the presence of something wicked. And if we're going to live in this world at this time, and what I mean is by living in the world, rather than just sort of gathering up, you know, circling the wagons and building these little ghettos for ourselves, you're going to live in the world, you're going to need a virtue that can manage and moderate that sorrow. Which, okay, that sorrow that, if unchecked, can lead to many problems, many vices, which puts a wall up around evangelism. Okay? And that virtue, Thomas says, is the virtue of patience. And it has to do with what St. Paul calls in 2 Corinthians 7, the sorrow that worketh unto death. What I've just been talking about, that's the sorrow that worketh unto death. It's a killer. Okay. Patience. Nowadays, we talk about patience as though it's this capacity we have for enduring delay, right? So I'm in the airport and, oh my gosh, it's been 20 minutes since I ordered my macchiato. Patience. All right. We talk about patience as though it's the capacity to delay things that are annoying or aggravating. And it has something to do with this, but it's somewhat peripheral to patience at its core. Patience is the virtue by which we moderate sorrow. We endure evil in patience. Now, there are many ways to misunderstand what this is like, patience. And to bring it into focus, I want to talk now just for a moment about the sense in which patience is a part of fortitude, courage. Thomas says that fortitude has two acts, and it's about fear and daring with respect to the most difficult dangers, namely dangers of death. So, when confronted with something so dangerous that you recognize, you know, this might kill me, okay? You are liable to respond with some mixture of both fear and daring. And fear, right, is the apprehension of this thing as inconquerable. And daring is the apprehension or the emotive response to the apprehension of this thing as somewhat conquerable. And what the courageous person knows and is, what they know is, with respect to this thing, this object of danger, and themselves, they know the fact of the matter. Like, this thing is dangerous, and it's so dangerous that in this moment, I'd better not run away. Can't do that because although it's confronting me in a way that is putting my life at issue, that there are goods that are worth contending with this difficult thing for. So I'd better bring my fear into alignment with what, with the reality of the moment. Excessive fear would mean running away. Okay? Excessive daring would mean running right toward it. Okay? That looks like fortitude, more like cowardice does, but it's not fortitude. Fortitude has to do with, on the one hand, the endurance of difficult things, of difficult dangers, the most deadly dangers. Okay? Enduring meaning withstanding them as one should, vis-a-vis everything else that one must do. Okay? And then, secondarily, with contending with that danger in the manner one should, when one ought to contend with it. And patience is like fortitude in this respect. It's about enduring, in the same way that fortitude is about enduring difficult, frightful things. Patience is about the endurance of sorrow. It's the endurance, it's the living among things that are actual causes for sorrow. So, what's that look like? Well, here are a couple of things that it can't be about. Okay, it can be no part of patience to merely suppress one's sorrow about the world. Can be no part of any virtue to ignore reality. We live in a moment of intense confusion, strife, and deep antagonisms, fragile peace. This is not good for anyone. Can be no part of patience to ignore all this. What patience does instead, rather than simply insulating oneself from that evil, which is guaranteed to, by the way, generate anger, fear, despair, hatred, it's to moderate one's sorrow in the recognition of the fullness of reality. It's to put these things into a certain, so it requires on the one side, on the part of prudence in the mind, clear judgment of the fullness of reality. And what follows with this, insofar as we are practiced in by the Lord's grace, the transformation of our minds, and we become habituated to this, a different way of seeing these things. We learn to moderate that sorrow, and this involves, too, the recognition of the good that we are confronted with in every moment, even in our great moments of sorrow. So, the antidote for sorrow is joy. If it were not the case, we wouldn't always be trying to fill ourselves up with or distract ourselves with temporary objects of pleasure. The antidote for sorrow is joy, and so it's a part of patience that we are able to endure difficult and grievous things with joy, and joy depends on the recognition of the good that we are confronted with, firstly in with the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. So think about that for a moment. God is the font of goodness. God is a perfect good, so good that you cannot fathom it. Desirable above all things. And to enjoy God would in no way diminish God's goodness. To be near God. Right? So if I eat a piece of pizza, that once I've enjoyed it, it's gone. God's not like that. God is a perfect, infinite good who can be enjoyed forever. And is no way diminished by your enjoyment of him. And he's made a home for himself in you. He's present to you and to us right now. We have also joy in the hope that is ours and the promises of the gospel. We're told here in Luke, you will be hated for all my name's sake, but not a hair of your head will perish. I have your back. I will never abandon you. This is not only cause for joy in the sense of a recognition of the good present to us now, but hope. The joy of hope is this, that when we cleave to the promises of Christ, we are bringing to ourselves, we're making present to ourselves these future realities, which are, in a mysterious sense, not simply future realities, but present realities as well. So remember these, so St. Paul will say things, you are seated in the heavenly. You're a child of God. That's what you are. You're not what everyone says you are. You're a child of God. This, for the reasons I've been describing here, is why St. Thomas calls patience the guardian of the virtues. It's not to say that patience is the root of every other virtue, but it is, in an important respect, their protector. Why? Well, for reasons that I hope are becoming plain, because when sorrow remains unchecked, and when it gives rise to anger and despair and fear, the vices that creep up around those other passions are serious vices that can and want to, like a lion creeping at our door, to overtake the charity that we've been given. Yeah? So, in this respect, patience is the guardian of the virtues, says Thomas. It uproots the obstacles to our growth in virtue. And on these same lines, he quotes in another work, the Catena Aurea on Luke, this passage from Gregory that I'll read for you right now. Gregory says, Gregory the Great, that is, therefore, through patience, we possess our souls. Because as we learn to govern ourselves, we begin to possess that which we are. Therefore, the possession of the soul is placed in the virtue of patience, because patience is the root and the guardian of all the virtues. This, I think, is a way to begin understanding what it is that we are told here in the Gospel of Luke, that in patience, in the virtuous endurance of sorrow, that we begin to possess our souls. As St. Gregory says, we become more, or become more aware of who and what we already are.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.